First off, I'd like to welcome you all to the Intellectual Property Law Society's first individual event ever. We have two of our distinguished professors from Chicago here who are going to talk about the recent Grotzer decision in the Supreme Court dealing with mainly with third-party liability and copyright. On the right is Professor Randall Picker. On the left, Professor Douglas Lichtman. I guess, without further ado, I'll just turn it over to them.
Thank you very much.
So, in 1984, the Supreme Court decided its decision in the Sony case. Sony dealt with what the court thought at that point as the VTR. That was the videotape recorder. We obviously know that as the VCR, and people refer to the Sony case as frequently the Betamax case. The issue there was is you had people like me taping shows at home. I clerked for Dick Posner. Dick Posner had an early Betamax. God only knows what Dick would tape, but nothing that the rest of us would watch, I'm sure. Right? Right. But you know, okay, Tweets is a masterpiece theater. Occasionally you miss one of those. And you wanted to see if Alistair Cook still was indeed dead. No, okay. In any event, Sony versus Universal, Sony announces, comes out with the VCR. The VCR obviously tapes shows. Boy, immediately the studio said, we're going to sue you. Met with Sony, showed up and said, this is an interesting product and we're going to sue you. And that's what they did. And the copyright analysis, for those of you who took my copyright class last spring, we'll see what you remember. The basic copyright analysis here is a two-piece analysis. Sony wasn't doing the copying, right? So you and I were doing the copying. So we're the ones making the copies. We're the targets. But suing us individually, very hard, very expensive, far better to chase Sony if you're the studios. How do you chase Sony? Well, you do that in a third-party liabilities theory. You say, Sony is making possible my copying. Sony should be liable. That's contributory copyright infringement, vicarious copyright infringement. Professor Lichtman is teaching copyright right now. Have we gotten that far? No, we have not. Okay, so you'll take it from Professor Lichtman this year, and you'll learn how that works. Okay, that's the idea. In the Sony case, the court said two things that are important. One, it said, you know, actually this home taping is fair use. Fair use is this very general doctrine we have in copyright law, which says there are circumstances under which what would otherwise be infringing copying is okay, it's fair, we'll let you do it. Home taping, time shifting of shows was fair use, plus a variety of participants in the case said copying was okay. The unlikely pairing of the National Football League and Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers said taping was okay for him, as I always put it, taping's okay in his neighborhood. And so taping went ahead as, okay, that's fair use. But the other part of the case, and the part of it that's famous for us, as it were, and that matters for the Grokster world that we're trying to understand right now, is this question of the third-party liability. And when we got to the third-party liability, the court looked at this doctrine and looked at the idea of contributory copyright infringement, looked at what the VCR did, and said, you know, the VCR is capable of many uses. Some are good, some are bad. What should we do with that? And here's what they said. Language, right? We're lawyers, or at least lawyers, we're going to be lawyers. Lawyers, language matters. Does not constitute contributory infringement if the product is widely used for legitimate, unobjectionable purposes. And then the next sentence, which is maybe the most famous sentence in copyright, is that fair, do you think? Yeah, probably. Need merely be capable of substantial non-infringing uses. Well, that's pretty protective, and indeed the Consumer Electronics Association, in the run-up to the Grotzer case, basically says it is on this doctrine that 20 years worth of innovation in the consumer product space has emerged. You can go into your garage, you can build your product, and so long as there are some uses which are good, you're not going to face third-party copyright liability. All right, well, we know what happens, right? Peer-to-peer music sharing takes off in a variety of forms. The Napster case is the first important case on that. Napster is not, Napster is a sort of a hub-and-spoke peer-to-peer system. Napster is at the center. No files flow through Napster, but Napster provides this master index. Any former or current Napster users here? Yeah, more hands on that. Don't read Supreme Court opinions, but download music. Okay, we all do that. Okay, gotta get priorities right, guys. All right, so the Ninth Circuit decides the Napster case. And in the Ninth Circuit, when they say, what should we do here? They've got this real
jurisprudential conundrum, as it were. The Sony case just showed you the language says substantial non-infringing use, and Napster says, you know, you could use our product to do lots of things. If you wanted to have a network devoted to sharing Supreme Court opinions, apparently no one wants to do that, but if you wanted to do that, you could do that. So, and think of all the works that are in the public domain. So the Project Gutenberg project has puts up texts that are in the public domain on the web. You go to their website, it is not really organized as peer-to-peer, but they say if you want to share those, go to it. All of those are capable of being shared by the Napster software, and so under the Sony test, you might say this is a dead bang winner for Napster. Some non-infringing uses exist, capable of non-infringing uses. Yes, it turns out most people are using it to download Britney Spears, that's my colleague Professor Lichtman used to do. But otherwise, right? Britney Spears was somehow always the example when he was talking. I won't go there. Ninth Circuit didn't do that. Ninth Circuit said, you know, the real question here is, does Napster have knowledge and control? Knowledge of specific infringing material, and can they exercise control? And the Ninth Circuit said, you know, they've got enough control. They could change the index, they could drop Britney from the index, and if they did that, that would let them exercise control. So they get around Sony based upon the knowledge and control that that Napster had. Okay, we get that. Well, so did the peer-to-peer guys, too. So the next iterations of this, in the Amster and the Grokster case, they obviously diminish the extent of control they have. They move more to pure peer-to-peer systems, supernode systems, not the kind of centralized indexing that you see in the Napster case. Judge Posner gets a hold of that in the Amster decision in the Seventh Circuit and says, that's not enough. The question is it possible for these guys to build a system where they could limit infringing uses? And if they could do that on a cost-effective basis, you know, the language of law and economics, not disproportionately costly, then they need to eliminate those non-infringing uses. So a design point. I had made that point, I will say, in an article. Professor Lichtman had made that same point in an article with Bill Landis, that Sony ignored the design possibilities associated with these products. And one of the things you should ask is can you design a product to limit the amount of infringement that takes place? And if you can do so, you need to figure out the right test. Judge Posner says disproportionately costly. That's what we ought to do. The Ninth Circuit gets the Grokster case, and Grokster says, not a chance in the world. The fact that you could do something, the failure to do something, completely irrelevant. The question is, do they have the kind of control over the system that we saw in the Napster situation? They don't. Grokster wins. Okay. Grokster, I'm going to talk quick so that Professor Lichtman will get at least 2 or 3 minutes. The Grokster case goes to the Supreme Court. It is the most... a lot of excitement in the copyright world, and it's, well, I don't know what I want to say, a complete bust? That's probably unfair. It's a huge disappointment in the following way. So what the Supreme Court does as a technical matter is, in deciding Sony, they reached into patent law and pulled out this section, section 271C, took that into copyright law. In Grokster, they reached one subsection up, they went to 271D. 271B in the patent law has this idea that if you're inducing in patent infringement, obviously in the patent statute, if you're inducing copyright infringement, then that's a separate basis for liability. That's enough. And Grokster gets beaten. They're bad guys, says the court, and I know. So Grokster is inducing liability. We can look at the language in just a second, but I will stop here in a little bit. Grokster's in trouble. Have to do something else. But on the thing that most of us really cared about, on the Sony decision itself, 3-3-3. As you know, as big a split as you can imagine. So Justices Souter, Thomas, and Scalia offer some ideas, but say basically the Ninth Circuit got it wrong. Justice Ginsburg says, you know, on the numbers we're seeing here, these guys should be liable under Sony. And Justice Breyer says, no, not at all. These numbers match up pretty well with Sony. The holding of the case, so you know, more language. Distributes a device, optic components used to infringe copyright, liable for the resulting acts of infringement by third parties. And then the court goes through what they see as a relatively clear evidence of inducement here. But the Ninth Circuit just didn't get Sony. Somehow the Ninth Circuit thought that Sony said that this was the only
we're podcasting. I guess I shouldn't walk away too far. This will be new. We'll see if this works. That's what that device is. The Ninth Circuit somehow understood Sony to say that this was an exclusive source of liability, that it was only if you could go down the Sony path that you would have liability. They say, no, not at all. Just like we see in patent law, that there are multiple paths to liability here, where the staple article of commerce doctrine, the 271C, is one piece of it, the inducement's a separate piece of it. We could have that separate piece here, and that's exactly what they did. Just didn't kill off those other theories, and those are the theories that are applicable here, and that's what the Supreme Court says. On the question of, you know, what was the direct evidence of intent here, I fly through the slides, the court says, well, there were a couple things. That these guys were trying to get at Napster users. In what I think of as the Supreme Court goes to business school, they said, let's look at the business model of this enterprise, and the business model was an advertising, eyeballs-driven vision that required a large number of users, and Supreme Court opinion sharing wasn't going to do that. You needed copyrighted stuff. And they didn't try to filter out infringing uses. And this is one of these points where the Supreme Court says something, and then they say, you know, we could make the law clear, we could do something else, let's do something else, right? So they add this footnote, and footnote 12 says, well, the fact, you know, we just said that they didn't try to block infringement, but, you know, we got to be very careful here, because as soon as we try to force them to block infringement, then we're stepping into product design, getting us too close to Sony. Liability. Ginsburg says, boy, I looked at the numbers. Liability under Sony, this is just a lot of infringing use. And Breyer basically says, not a chance in the world. Look at the numbers in Sony. Look at the numbers here. They roughly match up. I could go on, but I've talked for a while, so I'll stop. I have a paper on all this, but you know. Well, actually, a couple of them. And we could sort of, well, OK, I'll stop.
Let me add just a couple things. Randy dug into the law, so this actually works nice. Let me go high level instead, pull away from the cases, and make maybe four big picture points. Point one, big picture. Always ask yourself when you read a case, who won the case? And I think if you read Grokster and look up and ask who won, the answer is nobody won. Everybody lost. This is a loser all around. And run through the parties. Copyright holders, huge loss. Why? They didn't fight this thing to win on a legal theory based on intent. They did win on that. I guess that's better than nothing. But they didn't fight this in order to have a court say that if you can find someone who's foolish enough to leave emails lying around that says, hey, we can steal a bunch of copyrighted music, you could sue them. Why? Because now that this is the rule, no one will write such emails. Right? Anyone with any sort of competent legal advice, or even common sense, will realize now when you're running out of new technology, don't talk about the infringing uses. The whole sales pitch is, let's trade those Supreme Court opinions. Let's trade the Bible, and so on. Right, you tell a story that's legit, and you're done. So a victory based on intent is a hollow victory for the copyright holders. That is not why they brought the case. I can even say now, because they've said it publicly now, in the early strategy sessions, when we were all talking about it, I was working with the music industry, when they were writing the briefs, we talked about just hitting home intent and decided no, we pulled it from the original brief entirely because we didn't want to give the court an easy out. We wanted them to have to go and deal with the real issues, which we'll talk more about, and not duck out an easy, well, Grokster's a bad guy, this is an easy case. Then toward the end, as the filing deadline gets close, everyone gets chicken, and they put the intent argument in again, just so there's some chance to win, but winning on that was not the goal. Copyright holders lose. Technologists lose too. They fought this for clarity. They want clean rules so they could now tell everyone, go to your garage and build the next iPod, go to your garage and make the next cool internet sharing technologies, here are the rules, do this, don't do that. They didn't get clarity with this. Yes, there's some clarity for intent. Hide your intent, fine. Everything else, it's true, you read what the lawyers tell people now. Everyone else, no clarity at all. There are all these other arguments. Randy mentioned vicarious liability, contributory infringement. Those things are still completely up in the air as to their exact contours. The Sony rule, which I think all the technology people thought was clear and absolute, if we can show substantial non-infringing use, we're fine, that's now in a 3-3-3 split. Don't know how strong that is anymore. So if you're a technologist, you lost too, because you went to less clarity, not more clarity, so you don't have free license to create. The other party of interest, all of us, society, I think we lost too. And I don't want to say a lot about this, but the high level point is there was a dramatic, huge audience for this case. You had all these college students, some law students, some high school students, younger. You had all these people interested, passionate about this, writing about it on the internet, downloading music, having opinions. I don't think we looked really good in the end. If we had all these people watching and knowing the real issues, to then see the court decide the way it did, and not recognize why everyone cared about this case, copyright holders or technologists, I think we looked bad when we wasted an opportunity, when we had massive civil disobedience, followed by lots of public attention. I think we needed to do better, and we didn't. So point one I want to say is everybody lost. Point two, when people simplify this case, they pretend it's technology versus copyright. That's wrong, and you've got to recognize that to be wrong to fairly analyze the case. This is technology versus technology. Whichever way this case comes out, one technology is benefited and another is harmed. So if Grokster wins, gets a clean bill of health, sure, we see more investment in Grokster-like technologies. We also see more investment in encryption technologies, right? The music industry would fight back. They'd work in encryption, decoy files, and so on. So if Grokster wins, some technologies get a boost. Note, if Grokster loses, other technologies get a boost. When Grokster loses, now money flows into iTunes, the new Napster, right? Other technologies that are trying to be legal and develop along those ends. Money also flows into the new Grokster, call it Grokster 2. But whatever the new technology that will be, that will flout the law, and you know there's going to be one, when Napster died, we get Grokster, when Grokster, it's whack-a-mole, right? Money's flowing into the next mole. So whichever way the case comes out, some technologies benefit, some get hurt. If you frame it as, I love technology, therefore I know the answer, you're fooling yourself. The EFF phrased it that way, they were wrong. Malpractice, awful way of thinking about the case. Technologies on both sides. You might then think which way you want technology to go. Great, let's have that conversation, but don't pretend technology versus copyright. Point two. Point three, yeah, I jotted these down on the way in. This is just how I am. Point three, Sony rule is awful. It's wrong. Like Randy said, he wrote that. I wrote that. Dick Posner wrote that. We all agree. Sony rule is awful. Let me just say a little bit more about why. Sony rule, again, is a get-out-of-jail-free card. It says if you can show your technology has substantial non-infringing uses, you're fine. Imagine that rule elsewhere. Imagine I'm a criminal, I went some afternoon and robbed somebody. I go to court, I say, Your Honor, that morning, though, I candy-striped. All morning, candy-striping me. I did a lot of good in a small crime. Come on. No way. Right? Doesn't fly. And of course it doesn't fly. Legal rules all over understand that the important thing to do is give a marginal incentive to do better. We understand that even if you candy-stripe in the morning, you could still commit fewer crimes in the afternoon. Therefore, we always try to give you an incentive slash pressure to do better. The Sony rule doesn't. The Sony rule says if you can show me substantial non-infringing use, you're done. It can't be a good rule. We have to find a rule that continues to put pressure. Put pressure carefully. Don't be foolish about it. If Tim Wu were here, as he was last year, he'd be all upset about don't let law get in the way of technology. Absolutely. That means craft your rule smart. Don't have your rule say if you mess up, $40 million in damages. That's no good. People are too afraid to mess up. Design a rule that has a little bit of pressure, maybe forward-looking injunctive relief, but no backward-looking damages remedies. Right? We can think like lawyers and try to articulate a good rule, but the point is Sony is not a nuanced rule. Sony gives no incentive to do better, and we always want incentives to do better, because as Randy said, Napster could have done better. Right? If they wanted to help stop infringement of Miss Spears' music, they could have said, if you search Spears, we said no. Right? They could have done that, and Spears was popular then. It wouldn't have been to take the top 100 artists and watch for searches for them would have been easy, low cost to them, stop a lot of bad use. We need to give people pressure to do better. That's point three. Point four, last point, then we want to let you guys talk. Point four, copyright law, you're in my copyright class, you'll hear this again and again from me, you heard it last week already. Copyright law is always about choosing how to deliver a certain set of things to a certain set of people. Authors, we all agree, should get something for their work. Whether it's cash or rights, we could talk about authors should get something because we want them to create the work. Maybe authors should get something that keeps on giving them power and or cash because we want them to take good care of their work. Authors should get something. The question in copyright is not that. The question is what? What should we give them? Because you know what? We don't have to give them everything. We don't have to give you ironclad control over your work to get you to create. We can give you a little bit and keep a little back. And copyright law always is about choosing how much do we give and how much do we keep for the public. This case is just another flavor of that. We're in essence trying to choose now how should copyright holders get to enforce their rights digitally. Should they do it by suing individuals, going after the college students who directly infringe the copyrights? Should they get to do it instead by going after middlemen, Grokster, Napster, Verizon, which runs a big ISP, which maybe could have done better to stop these problems? I don't know, Dell runs computers, makes computer systems, maybe. You have to decide where you want to go, but this is a case that in the big picture is about choosing how do we let rights be enforced. My own leaning, I think Randy's with me on this, but my own leaning is I'd rather see these things enforced through the intermediaries than see them enforced through direct litigation against the quote-unquote bad actors. And I like that for a bunch of reasons. One, I want the college students to have a little bit more flexibility. Right? I think we got a lot out of all these college students making these technologies, playing with these technologies. And think about it. Because of copyright law, we got a brand new way to organize the internet. Right? But for copyright law, I doubt Sean Fanning sits up, stays up late at night, and creates peer-to-peer the way he did. Right? Because of copyright law, because the college students had some flexibility, we got these interesting technology steps. I value that. I think we'll chill all of that if everybody is nervous about being dragged into court as an individual. Worse, I don't think individuals are who I want to see in court. I want Grokster, because Grokster's going to come with the ACLU and EFF and a bunch of high-powered lawyers. I want Verizon. They'll come with their giant legal team. I want someone big and thoughtful to help me analyze the issues. So I have, you know, Madonna in the recording industry on one end, and I have Verizon and their lawyers on the other, and then maybe the court will get well-informed. But I'll tell you, if it's Madonna versus Picker, well, no, that's great, you know, absolutely, your pick would be good.
Pay-per-view.
Pay-per-view. Madonna versus, you know, a normal individual, we won't inform the court. They're playing ahead your pay-per-view, and I'm not touching it. Okay. All right. That's all I wanted to say on that. Should we open up? Do you want to follow up?
I'll say a few more things. Okay. I don't know how long the people in charge want us to talk. All right. I'll need to say a couple more things, and then I'll stop. And then we, because you guys know as much as we do. So the only thing, other thing I would say is what you know, I say in reprints I got this morning. So. Which is, I think we're really at a fundamentally, and also a paper from Jonathan Zittrain. Have you seen this paper or not?
The book.
No,
the generativity book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, we just did academic work bit for a second.
but I read it, and I didn't download last night. So
right. We're really at a very different point right now compared to where we were in 1984. And what that means is that. In 1984, all we had were basically freestanding products, and those products, you would sort of design them up front, and you'd put them out into the marketplace, and you would see what happened. And that's just not where we are with regard to most of the important class of products we're talking about today. And I think we need to think of those as what I call evolving products and network products, products that change even after you've taken them home. Right? So my colleague Lichtman extols the virtues of his TiVo. TiVo is a product that changes as, maybe changing right now as we speak. What does that mean? It means that it's a product that's networked, it's hooked up, it's communicating back to, as I think of it, the mothership. TiVo is obviously sending out new content that is, what shows should you watch? Doug, Britney's gonna be on, you gotta watch this.
All
right? Okay. If it was me and Madonna, it's got to be you. So you'll be the undercard. But also not only getting new show list things, but also adding and restricting capabilities. So there was a very controversial download that came with TiVo in the last 6 months, where they brought with it MacroVision's DRM scheme, Digital Rights Management scheme, which means that your ability to make copies was changing. Yesterday you could, today you couldn't. HBO is very sensitive about what you can record. They say go ahead and record our, as they call it, linear schedule. That is their normal broadcasting schedule. But the non-linear schedule, the on-demand schedule, don't want you recording that. They want to control the cash flows associated with that. TiVo changed. The product changed. And other products are doing this. So I have a list of products that I always talk about in these circumstances. I think you mentioned maybe this situation with the iPod. So the iPod is obviously an interesting situation. We have a faculty blog. I don't know if you're reading the faculty blog. I'll pitch that for just a second. I have a posting this week on the iPod. You should, you know, well, you ignore it like everyone else. actually, I think it's quite interesting. But the point of that is to say that the iPod is fused together with iTunes. You know, two pieces, sort of the hardware and the software side of it. Real Networks came out with a song service that would work with the iPod as a way of accessing, as it were, the installed base of iPods that were put into place. Apple evolved the software of the iPod so that somehow it no longer worked with Real Network's new service. And another example of that that you see is Google. Google Desktop Search, which is a program that I like a lot. But Google Desktop Search evolves on its own sitting on your machine. So at some point there was a problem with Google Desktop Search, a privacy problem. Do we need to do something? Nope, not at all. Paul C. and Google has taken care of it. And the software on my machine had changed. I hadn't done anything. And indeed, if you go back and look at the end user license agreement, I had, as we all had, clicked away our rights. I hadn't paid any attention. I clicked, I bought. Well, I didn't even buy, I just got. And so the point of this is these products can evolve. That wasn't where we were with regard to the VCR in 1984. There was no way for Sony to do something after the fact to the VCR and to the installed base of VCRs. Now we're in a position to make that decision. And I think what kind of continuing control we're going to have over these products, whether we're going to say, you know, you put out peer-to-peer software, okay, you need to be able to change it. As Doug said, it would have been straightforward enough for Napster to drop the top 100 off of Billboard. Easy enough to do that. I think that's the kinds of sets of duties we're going to talk about. And what was depressing about the Supreme Court opinion is there was really no recognition of the fact that the world we lived in 1984, an unnetworked, freestanding object world, very different than the world we live in right now, where everything's highly networked, everything communicates, everything can evolve. We might need a different set of rules for that world than we needed for the 1984 world. Okay, now I will stop. Okay. We'll take questions, comments, thoughts, and we'll turn on the lights.
Or maybe not.
I think if the court had not decided by intent, but had come into these other conversations that Randy has now started to walk us into, I think that would take us much closer to a satisfying decision. Copyright holders, I think, would have ended up with a rule that was a little better than the Sony rule, which would have been what they were seeking, at which time we'd then see deals cut, licenses made, and we'd move forward. And I think then, at least, we would have spoken to the issues that everyone was paying attention to. Right, what I was found unsatisfying, Randy found unsatisfying, and I suspect the college students found unsatisfying, is that the court didn't speak to the things we were all worried about. Do we have a set of rules that promotes the creation of the next generation of iPods? I can see the court really grapple with that in an interesting way. The importance of Sony, the same. If the technologists are saying, we need Sony, Sony is the centerpiece for creativity, by leaving Sony in a 3-3-3 split, very lawyerly to do, it's not before us, it's not right, let's just talk about it in dicta, but it completely misses what all the normal people understood to be the real issue. And so had they moved in the directions of dealing with the substance of the case, I think that would have been a great way to end it.
Please.
I wanted to ask you, Alice, about...
So I'm clearly just wrong in all the, you know, picking everything you said was right, the slide's very pretty. Okay, go ahead.
It's taken us years to get to that point.
Yeah, that's true, it's true. Being a dinosaur is tough.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. The test in Sony.
Yes.
The substantial infringement use. I don't really agree with your example of, you know, someone who's doing one crime in the afternoon but, you know, spending the entire morning doing good deeds. Because when Sony came out, it was a period of time where Sony faced two uncertainties. First, the fact that, you know, they're not the infringement, right? I mean, this is all about third-party liability.
Correct.
Unlike your example. And
correct.
And second, that it's a new technology. So I agree that Sony is not a good test, and I think that Professor Picker's paper about, you know, how you could modify this test to add some more incentives injured is better.
See, I am right.
Still.
Okay, good.
But still, you have to have some limit because it's a new technology, because people don't know what...
Absolutely.
I don't know what to do with that. I agree, and I say that in the paper, and you say, I'm not sure where you go with that. I mean...
So we have to distinguish the two points. So one point is, it certainly seems to be the wrong rule to say, do good, get out of jail. That's the move, that's the important move that the court hasn't made, the EFS resists. Absolutely. Now, we might not say we're going to take your good and measure it against your bad, and if they don't match up perfect, because, you know, how could you know when it's going to change over time? It's a new technology. Uses will change. You know, the internet, when it rolled out, was mainly about porn and copyright infringement. But we're glad we didn't shut it down.
Now we've gotten rid of the copyright infringement. The good stuff.
Right. And downloading people's papers. And that's the other dominant use that I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So we have to be careful. And I think that's right. And you know what? Even the copyright industry was ready to embrace some sense of this will change over time. Right. We can't solve this with a sledgehammer. And it is hard to craft the right rule verbally. Right. Posner's attempt is a couple adjectives. I don't know if that really does it for me either. We need to do something. All I want to say, that's not where the... If I can get the battle there, fantastic. That huge win, if we could get the EFF, ACLU, Tim Wu, right, Larry Lessig, if we can get all these people to at least stand up and say, you know what, we understand that a get-out-of-jail-free card probably doesn't give the right incentives. That'd be a huge step forward. And then let's take this firepower and use it to answer the hard question. The frustration with copyright in general and advocacy in this area in particular is they're not fighting the hard questions. They're missing the easy questions. Right? In my view, Lessig, Wu, Mark Lemley at Stanford, a lot of the other big guns in this area, they're getting the easy question wrong. They're pretending Sony is clearly right. Can't do any better than that. Let's not be afraid of trying to do a little better than that. Let's recognize it's hard, but let's not be afraid to try to give a little bit more incentive than that rule gives. And again, the battle isn't there yet. Picker and I agree, but the world doesn't.
Yeah, just to be so you guys don't lose sight of, I mean, that is a sixth floor of the University of Chicago view, and it's not a widely held view.
Right.
That's okay. That's how we live at the University of Chicago. So,
hey, we're acknowledging, you know.
Yeah, yeah, okay, that's fine. Well, you know, they had one on the table. Maybe the only important copyright holder in the United States Senate, Orrin Hatch, he does have copyrights apparently in songs, had legislation. Yeah, well, okay.
He couldn't do a slide. You got a slide on
yeah.
No,
that's
no.
What we should go. That's we should go find that one.
He had legislation that was out there. If you took the letters, it gave you the Induce Act. I don't remember what it was called exactly. And that would have been a legislative approach which would have brought into the copyright statute some version of an inducement. And that legislation, once the Supreme Court took the case, sort of stopped. They said, let's wait to see what happens. That was a natural thing to do. I think post-Supreme Court case, I think there is no movement for legislative response there. To the extent that there is a legislative response, it's on other issues. The broadcast flag, that's still a live issue in Congress. But nothing that I'm aware of on Induce or Sony or...
Right. It's even a little more depressing than that. After cert was granted, the Copyright Office got to sit in one room for 3 days, representative of every major player. They had the people from Intel, from Dell, from Microsoft, from the recording industries. They had the EFF folks there. They had some academics. They filled a room with all the people who you think might be able to hack through a reasonable response. And they wrote a rewrite of the Induce Act. This is Jewel Segal's project. Mm-hmm. So the number two guy at the Copyright Office, he sat down with all these people, made friends with all these people. They negotiated and they wrote a much improved bill. The one that was originally put out was sloppy. This was a really clean, nice bill. They had everyone to sign off, all the interested parties at the table. Then when they went home, none of them backed it. And that one died too. And so now I think it's definitely over because Congress tried and lost. And then the Copyright Office really put heart and soul into it and did it the right way. But get all the interested parties at the table, get them away from microphones so they don't do all the showmanship silliness, and ask them and tell what kind of rule could you handle that wouldn't chill the development of new technologies but would give a little bit of pressure to do better. Music industry, is that okay? They ran the exact conversation we would hope they ran. They wrote something that was pretty darn good, and that got no political support at all, and so there's going to be nothing.
Please.
Could you explain a little more where confidence on one of the points that technological innovation is going to win either way in these copyright cases, especially with the move, it seems, towards digital management.
Which is a technology.
Right, but I mean, that's but it's not technology that we're interested in. It's that positive innovation, I mean.
Well, I don't know. So, technology, right? It might be great to have interesting, effective encryption and monitoring systems, right? How does Google mess with Picker's computer? It's in part that they have an encrypted connection to Picker's computer, so Picker isn't worried or doesn't know that I can listen in and see everything on his computer when Google gets in, right? Encryption and digital rights management has great uses. No matter how you think about the copyright issues, right? We want new technology there, just like peer-to-peer is great uses outside of copyright. So my point wasn't that technology will win as compared to copyright. My point is more that some technologies benefit no matter which way the case goes. So if you want to argue for one side as the right answer for technology, you've got to pick technologies too. You'd be saying, I think it's more important to have new ways of moving information on the internet privately, then I think it is important to have encryption or this or that. You can have a full sentence that says, I like this technology better than that one, which isn't what anyone says. If they want to, great. EFF wants to say, we think technology wins if Grokster wins, because we value internet protocols more than we value legal systems for moving internet music around, like iTunes and the structures they need, and more than we value Grokster 2, the next coolest, more subtle, faster moving, extra private secret system. Right? If they want to weigh in, let them do that. No one has, I don't think anyone can, right, you look foolish if you want to vote on those technologies, I think. But I just want to make sure people get that you have to vote on technology. If you want to say technology is on this side of the case, you better be able to say the whole sentence. And nobody, to my knowledge, ever says the whole sentence.
Was the hand here before? Or
you're reading it was the legislature.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll just speak a little bit to BitTorrent and what you think about as far as its decentralization and the fact that it doesn't have a centralized index aside from maybe the torrent sites, which have been shut down successfully in the last couple months. And how, you know, there are different estimates that it's 20 to 40% of internet traffic at any given time, and there are movies and television shows
right.
daily. And obviously, there might be legally, you know, a hole to slip through, a crack to slip through for that without the centralized index. But as it gets bigger and bigger and becomes a bigger and bigger problem, and better clients come out that are much more easily used by, you know, Joe Schmo, it's going to be a bigger problem. What litigation do you see, any pending litigation or any way to attack that problem from the copyright owner's standpoint?
I think the guidance of the Supreme Court opinion, so Doug said, you know, don't have bad emails, okay? All right, well, we get that, though there was something, and I had this and I closed it, there was something in the Wall Street Journal yesterday of an outfit that the FTC has now taken some action against.
Right.
Did you see this in the journal yesterday?
Yeah, that's true. All this stuff, Google Print, they've released some damning emails in the last few days.
Oh, is that right?
And that's Google with fantastic legal advice. And they've written some emails that shouldn't be written.
Yeah, so I'll bring that up in just a second. So not that it's probably worth all of this.
Can't read that fast.
Really?
While Randy's doing that, let me
here it is. I'm sorry, right here. So, I'm sorry. So one piece of this is obviously controlling that, and notwithstanding what we think, you know, when lawyers speak, everyone listens. It doesn't work that way. So it's going to take a while before. We've taken care of the email trail. I think much more importantly, though, much more interestingly, is this question of the business model issue. So one of the things the Supreme Court emphasized was the fact that these guys were running a business model which was tied to eyeballs, tied to advertising. I think the real question is, what does that mean for people who are much cleaner and in some sense much more ideological about this? True open sourcers who say, I'm just believing freedom and I'm putting this out there. I'm not trying to monetize. To monetize these things, there's a bunch of extra work that has to go into that to make that a serious undertaking. And I think, obviously, it's easy for me to say, well, the more monetization you do, the greater this opinion is going to matter for you. Well, the more you're just someone who wants to craft good software and put it out into the public, I think the less you're at risk. Now, BitTorrent itself, I know we've started to go back and look at the emails there to see why that was created, and I gather there's some uncertainty about accuracy of documents and the like. With some piracy reference.
Well, one point in his favor that I think that has been made is that he doesn't encrypt the data so that it's possible to track the users, and it's a completely open source project, and the man's moved on to other things, and they have just incorporated it, I think, actually, trying to make money from legitimate uses. But he does have a couple legs down on the thing and saying, hey, from its inception, it was not a money making venture, although he's probably very aware of the abuses that would entail.
Right. It's one other thing to add. It might be almost impossible to shut down peer-to-peer in its various forms, whether it's BitTorrent, Grokster, and so on. I think even the music industry recognizes that. Two things. They fight the battles just to make it less attractive, right? It's always just the margin. How much better is it for you to go get it through one of these services rather than iTunes? So if I make iTunes good enough and fast enough with all these cool gadgets and easy interface and cheap, and that a little harder by threatening to sue and disrupting the nodes, that might be enough. Point two, I don't know what Randy would say to this, because we've never talked at this angle. For me at least, I talk with rhythm about these things not because I really care about Madonna or Britney Spears, couldn't care less. I think it's right important to get the law here right, which is to say third-party liability is everywhere. Right? It is also patent law, it is also tort law, and the same mistakes they're making in copyright, they make, for example, in patent law. The exact same criticisms that we make of the Sony rule, you can make of the patent statute. I get excited about these things. I want to get the law right for those cases. Right? Whether Madonna makes exactly the amount of money she makes now or 20% less, I don't think it'll change that much. I think the quality of music will stay similar and so on. I'm not excited about those. Rhea is. I'm not. I'm excited about getting the law right. So even if we can't get BitTorrent fixed, point is, let's get the third-party analysis down right, because in patent law, it's not so easy to duck the radar screen, do it from your home, do it in small, isolated groups. And in patent law, I want to get the third-party liability right as well.
I think the other thing we'll see on BitTorrent, and it's a general point, and it's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, is trying a different angle, and that's pricing bandwidth differently. So 10% of the people use 90% of the bandwidth. Well, as soon as we move away from all-you-can-eat bandwidth pricing, all of a sudden that's going to change the dynamics of that. And so that's the instrument I would start to push on if I really wanted to control BitTorrent.
Those users can't use so much bandwidth.
Yeah, exactly. Or they can use as much as they want, but it's going to cost them a bunch of money. Please. I keep calling the people.
Go ahead.
Right there. Yes?
I've actually read I know there's been some criticism of the Supreme Court recently, in general, that, you know, just the kind of the basis of the court's makeup at the moment, the fact that most of them have come from academia, they tend to have come from sort of con law.
That was a good thing, right? They come from academia.
Oh,
I thought I just heard you for a second there.
I think maybe more importantly that they tend to come from sort of very heavily con law oriented.
I hear you.
they don't have any of the systems that they use. Current members of the court, maybe I honestly don't know about Roberts, I suppose, but prior to his nomination, they just haven't been exposed to this. A lot of the kind of more technical corporate and IP kinds of issues. I think somebody at the Institute for Justice said that with the exception of Justice Breyer, nobody on the court has any idea what corporate litigation looks like now. And so I'm just wondering if, since, you know, obviously IP would seem to fall under the rubric of things the court is just not going to be exposed to on a regular basis. I doubt any of the justices are using Grokster on a regular basis. Is this the kind of issue that, you know, that lawyers or society as a whole can expect to be clarified by the Supreme Court? Is that holding the bar too high? Because they're just not, they don't have an intuitive sense of what social news are.
I stare at our podcasting device as I ponder
response. Your nomination's at risk right now.
So, you know, I mean, I don't know what to make of that. Obviously, Justice Breyer, you know, deep knowledge of copyright regulation. He was an academic. I don't know what that means. He really knows. He's like us. That means he's a smart guy. No, that means he's...
And good-looking.
Good-looking, exactly. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I don't really worry so much about that, I have to say. They get smart clerks, a lot of you guys. Great lawyers show up in the court on the whole. As this litigation has evolved, and what Doug said was dead right on this, the nice thing about this kind of litigation these days is there are really smart people on both sides. So you really get a fair and meaningful hearing. I guess I'm sort of a believer in Article III generalism. If I'm going to be hostile about the Supreme Court, that's probably not where I'm going to start, I guess.
Right. And we should point out, they set up Grokster in chambers when they were studying the case. Their law clerks set it up on the computers, and they were downloading their Neil Diamond or whatever it was they listened to. they got a take. And then also led to strategic play. There was a campaign by people to put up public domain work on the network. So when the justices logged onto Grokster, they got the impression that it was widely used to move Randy Pickler's scholarship.
Yeah.
It wasn't Randy who set that up, but yeah.
No, yeah,
so that's
exactly.
One. I'm with Randy. Smart people, right? Smart people in front of other smart people should be able to make a lot of progress on tough issues. That said, in earlier this week I was in a panel with the Federal Circuit judges, and they were talking about should it be a requirement to serve in the Federal Circuit that you've spent some time in the district courts first. And it was the same kind of point, that you can't make federal patent law and do all the nuances of patent law without ever having run a patent trial. You have no idea what it really feels like. All the district court judges said yes, carefully, because they too were being listened to by their bosses. But yeah, it would be great if you came and sat with us for 6 months and understood. And the Federal Circuit judges were split. I kind of like the idea of people seeing what litigation looks like. Rather than, you don't have to run businesses maybe, but you ought to know what litigation looks like down below before you rule on it from up above.
Please.
You sort of made this comment about the T-Bowl and the mothership.
Yes.
I'm sort of concerned about what sort of obligations you're putting on program providers. I mean, T-Bowl is obviously a money-making thing. I have open source equivalents of T-Bowl connected to my team. And what sort of obligation you put on those people?
Well, I think that you're right to say that when you put a product into the marketplace, it has consequences. And that's all we're saying here. And we've had a rule, the Sony rule, which just strikes us as not doing a good job of taking into account the full set of consequences associated with the product. And so I'll say that's the discussion I want to have. And I think the notion that you can say, well, this could be used in a good way sometimes. That shouldn't be enough. And we should figure out what kind of, we're lawyers. We ought to figure out what kind of legal regime we want to do apply to that. And I have, the article has one pitch on that. I don't know if that's right. We could talk about that. But I think that's the discussion we need to have. And think about how products liability has evolved, right? I mean, it evolves over time, common law method. I mean, we could, any number of possible ways of doing that. That's not a satisfactory answer, but it's the real answer, I think.
I wanted to ask on your question concerning that, or your statement that copyright doesn't choose technology. When you're looking at sort of what you might call semi-transitory copies, like computer RAM or cache, where it sort of exists to many people only for a limited time, but it's still protecting their copyright by the definition of the law, don't you feel there that Sony, if we adopted your standard, would actually impose maybe significant difficulties for people working in those technologies to limit the infringing uses?
Well, so it depends. You're always just driving the technology. So you're telling me the only way to accomplish a given task is by doing it that way, by having limited copies in memory. I don't think so. Right? Watch the Napster to Grokster to Now path. Right? The time of Napster, I think people would have said the only way to do this is a centralized index service where everyone goes to, and of course that turned out to be wrong. The moment we said Napster is no good, Grokster comes into being. And so I think we'll always see technology react to the law and the law react to technology. My point is not that all of technology survive no matter what the law is. That, of course, would be wrong. It's that the law pushes technology, it never smushes technology. So we'll move to a different way of doing it and another set of strategies. It's always this back and forth rather than the law saying that technology is completely out of business. That's not the normal way these things work.
I couldn't help but read the last line here where, despite the Supreme Court ruling,
file sharing activity continues.
Yeah. I was wondering, to be what your opinion is of where the next battle is.
Google print. Front page.
Well,
last
but
week.
But I mean, yeah, but that's a different kind of thing, right? I mean, Google print is. I mean, Google is. What's interesting about Google, from my perspective, is the way in which it's such a centralizing force, right? That's what's interesting about Google. Google. The fact that they basically provide services rather than products means that they do have this continued control. I've blogged on Google on the faculty blog a couple times too, and you can read those if you're so inclined. So that's, I mean, we're going to have a fight there. Google is unbelievably well situated to have that fight in the sense that, like Sony in 1984, they can afford the fight about fair use. You and I can't really afford to do that. Sony could do it. Google Print can do it. That's great. Let's have that fight. I know you've blogged that you think they'll lose. I'm skeptical that they'll win, I have to say, but we'll see. But that's certainly one important fight. I think where we go to video is the next issue, I think, right? And as more video content hits the web, and I think that will be And obviously the video business is very concerned about being Napsterized as they think of it. I do think that, you know, there are reasons, and all I say is look at the blog. I do think there are reasons why video may play out differently than music. And that's because the TV guys feel cut off from their customers. The emergence of cable introduced this intermediary, and now the TV guys are saying, we can do what they're calling cable bypass. We can get around the cable guys and go directly to our customers. So when Apple announced the video iPod last week, they brought with it Desperate Housewives, right? You can go there the day after Desperate Housewives is broadcast for $1.99. You can download it and watch it. And their willingness, ABC's willingness to do that deal is in part cultural and what Iger wants to do, the guy who runs it these days. But also I think a sense that this is their way of trying to get around cable. And cable is from their perspective, cable is free riding on their content and they're getting nothing from it.
So one thing, we might see less litigation. I hope that when this ends, that's what I always was saying, that this is the last round of copyright litigation for a while, that we'll see people try to cut deals, we'll see changes to the business models, we'll see the cable companies build in the TiVo and give it to you as part of cable service instead of fighting TiVo in court. I thought we'd move away from litigation. That's why I said Google Print. Google Print has proven me wrong on that. Right? All of a sudden, here again, we have another behemoth entity coming in doing a lot of widespread arguable copyright infringement and thumbing their nose at the property right. Right, you don't see settlement negotiations working out, they're nothing, they go right back to court, which surprised me. I would have thought that Google's team would have watched this and come and cut deals, figure a way to do it without starting all the hullabaloo again. So that we're back in court surprised me. I think I would have wanted to say, and wish I could say, is we'll go back to business for a little while. Everyone's tired of wasting their energy in litigation because the payoff was so little for everybody.
So you are seeing some of that. So the Grokster, the guys who founded Grokster started a company called Mashbox. Mashbox has cut a deal with Sony to do what they're going to describe as legal peer-to-peer. So we'll see how that works. The idea behind doing that, you could imagine easily doing that. It's going to require some sort of DRM. You're not going to like that, right? I mean, I need to be able to send the object to Doug over the computer such that Doug can listen to it two or three times, and then when Doug wants to listen to it the fourth time, the object phones home and says, okay, his three uses are up. Doug, do you want to buy? You've had a chance to sample. That's the kind of object that would make sense. And then when Doug wants to share music with me, he can send it to me. I can sample it, and then we can move on. But it's going to require that kind of again, technology to make that work. And that's, I think, what Mashbox hopes to do. Got something here.
Where are we in terms of damages right now? It seems that, I know in the case of Google Print, Google is already facing huge statutory damages. And the case of Real Networks, their last SEC filing had some ominous claim statements there, some ominous advisories saying basically we state the company's financial future on the outcome of the Apple suit. We don't know what's going to come of this. Is it appropriate to have a huge liability for infringement generally, and especially in a situation where the environment is characterized by uncertainty of what the law is?
I think the answer is no. I mean, I think we don't have the numbers right. So, but I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about that.
It's designed to force you to negotiate, though. So maybe the right answer is yes. Right? What we're trying to do is say, don't act and then decide if it's legal. You do a token infringement and sue, or pick up the phone and talk to somebody, right? Google or mp3.com or Real, right? They're getting in trouble because they did a ton of stuff. And then they decided to figure out if it's really legal, rather than if it's legal in their dreams, or if their friends tell them it's legal. But is it really legal? You don't need to do a million test copies in order to get into court and figure it out, or to call the other side and cut a deal. So that it might be designed to force people to the table early, in which case maybe the numbers aren't big enough, because look at all these people who should have been well advised to do this in a small way and come to the negotiating table who did not. So I don't know, there's no reason to bet your company on stuff like this, if you're well advised.
We were here next, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering how far the vicarious liability here reaches, for example, with ISPs and who else, and which might be the most effective targets.
He has a paper on the ISPs, so why don't you talk about that?
Right, so I've argued in writing that the ISPs should have some liability to do something, right? Not liability they have to pay for every bad act, but again, if there are easy things they could do to discourage bad acts, and they're not doing them, that should trigger liability, some sort of a negligence kind of rule.
that we ought to look, because ISPs are the gateway through which everything happens. Seemed like a natural spot to enforce the law. So where you go further than that, I don't know, do I want Dell thinking about this stuff? Maybe not. And it's hard to articulate what the right decision points look like. Like ISPs look to me like an easy case, that they are a great position to enforce, monitor, and so on. And if they're not, that's pretty bad in my view. But it's hard to draw these lines. You could keep rolling down, you know, from Dell to Intel to Micro, right? You could keep going to so many entities, and we certainly don't need everybody in court enforcing the law. We just choose a couple and get them doing it.
And just under the current situation, would you think that they are liable, or is that, or are you suggesting that there should be some more legislation?
Yeah, I don't know. They think they're not liable.
Right.
The world seems to think they're not liable. No one's sued Verizon yet. Although I wouldn't take that off the table. It wouldn't shock me if someone does. No one's sued Dell yet on this either. Even for internet security stuff. Right, you could think of a great lawsuit against Verizon and Microsoft and Dell for all these worms and so on that we're getting hit with if we think they could be doing a little more to protect us. But yeah, the world seems to think the law doesn't get them right now. I'm not sure.
We were either just told we're number one, or one more question. Yeah, okay, thank you very much. Okay, one more question, right there.
Don't you think a lot of this, you mentioned two things, that there was a lot of civil disobedience, and then when the Supreme Court cases started going around the news, there was a lot of people watching. I mean, it's really hard for me as a college student that was now like to sympathize with Lars Ulrich when he was saying, oh, Metallica, you know, is earning $1 million less because he's not in those kids, you know, downloading music. And then you have news articles that say that, Warner Brothers is mad at Apple because they could be charging more for their music. 99 cents isn't enough. Like, don't you think there's also a PR battle element in which people will say, well, these guys are just greedy. They're not talking about the copyrights. What they're more worried about is that recording artists will follow David Bowie's model and say, I don't need the recording industry. I can just distribute it on the internet. Like, don't you see that there's also a PR battle that isn't even being, I guess, fought, that record companies could be more conciliatory towards their customers?
Yeah, I think it's totally right. Every time I work with clients in these areas, the first message is clean up the PR. You can't come across as property rights absolute. I'm the author. I control everything because it's not the law and it doesn't sell. You've got to understand there's some things that ought to be free for all to use. There is a fair use defense out there. It's hard. I've never had any client listen to me on that. They all read the briefs. If you're bored one weekend, read the first two pages of the music industry brief. Read the first two pages of the brief Picker and I signed. It's a very different tone. And now we frame the issue from the get-go. We scream to the court that there's a tension here. There's this side, there's that side. There's a lot of things at stake. Got to be balanced. Party briefs don't. Both sides, right? The copyright people are very strong property grr, and the loving, touching, feely, let it all be free side doesn't acknowledge at all that, you know, not everyone can be David Bowie. That some people need to be able to own their music and sell it because you can't go on tour and fill a concert hall and make your money that way, or you're not already filthy rich, right? There's a whole medley of issues that we talk about here to you, and wow, the parties would learn to talk that way too in courts. We'd move so much faster through all the issues. But everyone gets so worked up. You'll see if you do moot court, you'll come to believe the side you were randomly assigned to is the right side. I guarantee it. And that's just how it works.
I mean, I think what's happened here is that the technology engineering has outrun the economics engineering in two. And so, you know, when those get out of sync, you're going to fight for a while. The iPod's a great example. So more on the blog. But, you know, Apple's making a bunch of money off the iPod. They can afford not to make very much money off the music. Right, that may drive iPod sales. The music guys aren't similarly situated. So, okay, we'll stop.